Hi, thanks for coming. I'm just going to quickly mention what happened in the first two lectures. The first lecture was about subject matter, and it kind of painted a picture of subject matter as kind of a way of working some kind of structure or contours into logical space. An analogy might be this: if you look at a contour map of some region, it's two-dimensional, but you can sort of read the depth into it by just sort of trying to plot lines where you cross the largest number of contour lines. Those are the ones that are rising and falling the quickest. It's kind of the same here. There's going to be a lot of lines through logical space, and where the lines are bunched up, you see what's changing, so to speak, along the axis that sort of goes through them, and that's roughly what you're talking about. So that's the conception of subject matter. And then last time, we used that notion to explain a notion of partial truth, which is truth about a particular subject matter, less than complete truth, and then we applied it to everything in sight. So last time it was just like examples, 10 examples. And today we're going to go like super theoretical again, but I'm going to try to like steer around the super, super theoretical part. So start with some history. I'm going to start by extrapolating on extrapolation. So one famous problem of this kind is the one that Hume raised. Why should unobserved parts of reality continue patterns that we notice in observed parts? Unobserved emeralds could just as easily be blue. They turn out to be green. That's a puzzle about what I'm calling type 1 or inductive extrapolation. That's sort of the best known kind. So I mentioned a pattern. I said, inductive extrapolation is the question, how do we continue a pattern that obtains in the observed part of reality to the unobserved part of reality? And the second puzzle is, well, what do you even mean by the pattern? What is the pattern that you're trying to continue? So resemblance of later emeralds to, observed emeralds could just as easily be in point of grueness as greenness, right? What's really supposed to count as extending the pattern is they should be green. But Goodman asks, well, why isn't the pattern of being grew the one that's extended? So that's the puzzle of projective extrapolation. Now we get to Kripkenstein's puzzle. So what I took for granted, so the first one sort of takes for granted we know what it is to extend a pattern. The second one kind of asks what it is to extend a pattern. How do we judge what the patterns are? How do we justify the choice of green over grew? The third one says, what do you even mean by the choice of green over grew? So the samples guiding my past use of the word green were just as much grew as they were green. So who's to say that I didn't wind up meaning grew by my word green, so that in accord with my past usage, I really should be calling blue things green? So that's the third puzzle that Kripke talks about in Wittgenstein on Rules and Private Language. And the fourth puzzle, actually, Kripke talks a tiny bit about in the afterword or the appendix to that book. And it goes something like this. Well, here's an example that you may have heard of that sort of brings out, makes it recognizable and brings out what's problematic about it. So Wittgenstein in the Investigations says, well, look, you all know what it is to be 5 o'clock here, right? In fact, coincidentally, it just was 5 o'clock here. Okay, so what is it to be 5 o'clock on the sun, he asks. He says, well, it's simple. I can explain that in terms of things you understand. You know what 5 o'clock here means. You know what same time as means, right? I'm going to put those two together. 5 o'clock on the sun is same time as it is here when it's 5 o'clock here. And, of course, it's not that simple. Although there was, actually, in looking through this, there was like a breakout around the same time that people started arguing that numbers are indeed not green. They started arguing that, in fact, you can make sense of 5 o'clock on the sun. And Mackey had a theory of this. Various people did. But that's been forgotten. I can't make sense of 5 o'clock on the sun. So what's interesting about this kind of puzzle is you've got a certain kind of concept that makes sense in a certain kind of, in our local kind of neighborhood logical space. And then we're trying to extrapolate it to some other neighborhood, and it's not clear that there's the guidance that we would need to do it in a definite or correct direction. And so Kripke, commenting on this, says, without the intervention of any arcane philosophical skepticism about rule following, there really is a difficulty about extending the old concept. Certain presuppositions of our application of this concept are lacking. So defying presuppositions or implications, that really does sound difficult, but we'll give some examples where we seem to do it in a minute. Of course, what Wittgenstein's really, his real target here is how do I extrapolate, right, from the pain that I understand in my own case to the pain I would attribute to somebody else. This is none too easy a thing to do. That's the so-called conceptual problem of other minds. And so this is going to be more like the conceptual problem of everything, or everything you might try to sort of extrapolate. So here's some examples where it just sort of seems like to come naturally to us. If you kind of Google words like except maybe not, or with the possible exception of blah, you come up with like thousands of examples of these. So here's a few. A gratin is a quiche, except it might not be baked in a shell. Similar figures are congruent, except they might not be the same size. Necessity is like duress. I have no idea what either of these things are. Necessity is like duress, absent the requirement of coercive pressure. I think a lot of legal concepts are kind of defined this way. You know this one, right? Well, just suspend that aspect of it, and now you've got the new one. They did equally well, instead of like two students, apart from some minor addition errors. These are just ordinary things to say. They presumably make some kind of sense, and we need to kind of figure out how that works. So the question is, how do we extend a content to a region of logical space where some of its implications aren't satisfied, or some of its presuppositions are unsatisfied? And I'm going to call that type 4, or content extrapolation. And here's a little chart that kind of goes through what the different sorts of extrapolation are. In the case of regularities or inductive extrapolation, we're going from actual emeralds. It's supposed to be a pattern, an extrapolation within the domain of actual emeralds from the ones that have been examined to the ones that haven't been examined. And the result's supposed to be that an unexamined emerald will be green since past emeralds were. Right? That's the intended result. In the case of Goodman's puzzle, we're trying to extrapolate, I suppose, over the domain of possible emeralds. We know what the pattern was that obtained among these ones, but we want to know what would it be for that pattern to extend to other emeralds maybe we haven't seen or maybe we'll never will see. And so the result we want is F, some new emerald, should be green to resemble past emeralds. Then with the Kryptenstein paradox, the result we want is that a certain thing counts as green to go by our actual assessments of things as green and not green. And then what we're going for is something like this. So here's an example, which I won't come back to. But take grass is green. Okay? And imagine, so that, you know, that has this sort of noun phrase, grass. I assume that there's some presupposition of there being some stuff, grass. Okay? Now, there are people around who don't believe in macro objects like blades of grass. Okay? Kind of nihilists or atomists or something of that kind. Okay? We might ask ourselves, whether the remark that grass is green has any implications for the world that they think they live in. And you might think it ought to, because whether there really are macro objects or whether there really are like sums of these atoms is kind of orthogonal to the issue of green or not green. So you might ask, well, how can we sort of extend as a courtesy to them in their sense of where they are in logical space the notion that we have here of grass being green? And so what we want, we're going from presupposition satisfying worlds to presupposition violating worlds, and what we want is that a world satisfies grass is green, waiving the requirement of there being grass, okay, to go by the worlds where there is grass. Okay? So grass is green really does imply there's grass. Nevertheless, the idea is you could bracket that requirement and get a relatively determinate result for what it would be for grass to be green if you waive the requirement of there being grass. That's the idea. I'm not going to defend that particular version of it at all. So, type 4 extrapolation. So in one way, it's actually quite a bit easier and more straightforward than the traditional kinds of extrapolation, because they're all the puzzles that I raised initially were kind of skeptical problems, you know. Nobody really doubts that you can kind of do induction and figure out what's going to happen next. Nobody doubts that we can extend patterns. Nobody even doubts that we can sort of develop you know, a way of using a word that we could, that then guides us in our future applications. Everybody, these things are possible. The philosophical puzzle is like, how are they possible? But here we're dealing with something that isn't always possible. Sometimes you can extrapolate, sometimes you can't. We'll look at examples both ways. And so there really is kind of something you can sink your teeth into here. It's not like, how do we answer the skeptic? It's like, why does this sometimes work? Why does it sometimes not work? And how does it work when it does? So that's going to be the question. So that's one way of comparing the type 4 to the earlier kinds of extrapolation. There's also a way in which it's harder, because, you know, the notion of being green does not imply the notion of being examined. So if someone says, well, how do I extend being green to this other region of like possible object space where things aren't examined, it's not really a problem. Green was never hemmed in by examined to begin with. It just continues along its merry way the way it was going anyway. But here we're talking about cases where we've got a content A that really does imply a content B. And so, strictly speaking, there is no way, literally, of extending A beyond the B region of logical space. It doesn't go there, right? It can't be true if B is false. Nevertheless, we're proposing that it might be possible to kind of work out some system for how you would do it if you were going to do it. Okay. So, I say a system. You might say, look, why do we need a theory of how subtraction works? I'm calling it sometimes extrapolation, sometimes subtraction. If you think of it sort of geometrically, you're kind of extrapolating from one region of logical space to another one. If you think of it kind of just in terms of contents, you've got an A that implies a B, and you're saying, let's just suspend that implication and see if there's a well-defined remainder. So why do we need a theory of subtraction or extrapolation? You might say, look, you know, it's obvious that it doesn't work in the Wittgenstein 5 o'clock in the sun case. It's obvious that it does work in the kind of similar triangles defined in terms of congruent triangles case. We can just tell in particular cases. Well, in fact, we can't tell in interesting cases. And the judgments that people come to about this tend to reflect their kind of philosophical temperament as much as the particulars of the case. And so there's two big camps here. There's the Mysterian camp, I call it, that thinks it's all a very mysterious business. And there's like an optimistic or Pollyannish camp. So let's start with the optimists. So optimists say, okay, you've got this A, it implies B. We'll just take the B away, and there won't be a problem. They act kind of like success is guaranteed. We'll meet some optimists in a little while. So here's a story that kind of fits with the optimistic frame of mind. It's from the 1980 presidential debates in the United States. The moderator was like asking questions of the candidates. It was Reagan versus Mondale, and asked Reagan some question about de Gaulle, and Reagan said, I don't believe I've heard that name, and the audience gasped. And then the moderator turned to Mondale and says, isn't it a concern, like how many things, you know, your opponent here doesn't know? And he said, I think this actually comes from Mark Twain, It's not what he doesn't know that bothers me. It's what he does know that just isn't true, right? And you kind of can make a little bit of sense of that, And if I tell you that, you know, that person knows something bracketing the truth requirement, you almost think you can make some sense of it. Well, I'll come back to that a little bit later. So the Mysterians think this is all very kind of naive, and in fact, the described operation makes no sense. Here's a story that they'll like. It's supposed to be a conversation that Einstein had with some citizen, or it might just be an old Jewish folktale, I'm not sure. Looks like this. First person, how does the telegraph work? I don't really get how words can go down wires. Second person, this is Einstein, let's say. A dog stretches from, you know, Minsk to Pinsk, and you pull the tail in Minsk and the head barks in Pinsk. And then question comes, all right, so that's like the wired telegraph. What about the wireless telegraph? And then the answer is supposed to be exactly the same, just without the dog, right? And you kind of think, that's not really an answer at all. Like you say, well, it works just the same except for the only thing that enabled it to work. Okay, and so that's the model for the Mysterian of how subtraction is. So Wittgenstein and his Mysterian moments gives examples kind of along these lines. He says it. One of them, he says, high is high. It's just sometimes you hear it and sometimes you see it, like a high note in music or something way up on the wall. I think he also says pitch is pitch, except sometimes it's in music and sometimes it's on the roof, right? That one you can sort of see, it's like a bit of a stretch. Okay. All right, so here are some philosophical... here are some cases in the history of philosophy that people have reached for this kind of tool without necessarily like worrying a lot about whether it works. And so I'm going to just give a list here. First one is from Wittgenstein. He doesn't actually say this, but some people have said this. What is it to try to raise my arm? Well, trying to raise my arm is raising my arm. You just bracket the part about the arm going up. It's what's left of my raising my arm when you bracket my arm going up. Goodman loves this kind of operation. A law-like statement, he defines a law-like statement as, it's just like a law, but laws have to be true. Law-like statement doesn't have to be true, but that's the only difference. Law-like statement is a law, except it might not be true. Everybody has a notion of like an experience as of blah, right? I don't know how this notion has actually survived given all the pressure that the notion of narrow content has been put under, but it still seems to exist alongside the kind of ruins of narrow content. There is having an experience as of a tomato. It's like seeing a tomato, except maybe there isn't a tomato there. We kind of can understand that. This is something from Whitehead. Prehension is comprehension, except maybe not intellectual. Okay, I'm sure you can work that out yourselves. Here's a famous one, familiar to Oxford types. Quasi-remembering something, the notion that appears in Neo-Lockean theories of personal identity, is just like remembering an event, say, except you might not have been the person who originally had the experience of that event. It could have been somebody else. Okay. You could have a more general notion of quasi-memory. It's like remembering, except what you remember might not be the case. Okay. Theory is empirically adequate if it's true, ignoring what it says about theoretical entities. Similar thing for nominalistically adequate. Putnam, in his early stuff about solipsistic analogs of the attitudes, talks about how, you know, in Japan, people kind of fall in love with characters and novels, and they even commit suicide, I think, out of jealousy. He has some example like this. So solipsistic jealousy is jealousy, except that the target of the jealousy may not be there. Warrant, defined by Plantinga, whatever, makes the difference between knowledge and mere true belief. Goodman suggests the following, which I mentioned just because it's kind of like, I can't make sense of it, but it seems kind of cool. To be fragile is to exemplify what a thing's breaking adds to its being dropped. Here's a version of it that actually makes a little bit more sense. A thing is green if it has what looking green adds to being under observation. obviously, a lot of these won't bear up under much scrutiny, but they're kind of interesting to think about. Finally, we got the notion in moral philosophy of like scare quotes analogs of evaluative terms, right? So we might not sort of agree with the moral code in a certain place, but we might still say, well, you know, so-and-so is chaste or pious or something like that, with quotations around it. We don't subscribe to the underlying sort of normative code, but nevertheless, it has a certain kind of descriptive import, and we're trying to just get at that. So what is it for an act to be, scare quotes, courageous? Something like this. Courageous minus any suggestion that it's thereby admirable or kind of ranks high on some value scale. Okay. Now I'm going to give you an argument for mysterianism and an argument for the Pollyannish or optimistic attitude. So the first one is by this guy named Ronald Yeager, who taught at Cornell and then left philosophy as far as I know, but he's working on this idea that Wittgenstein has, that it might be an interesting question: what is left over if you subtract that the arm goes up from the fact that I raise my arm? And he makes the following point. He says, look, you're really trying to define something that's like the arithmetical notion of subtraction, right? Because what is 5 minus 3? It's the r such that r plus 3 is 5. And he says, Yeah, that's fine, because there is a unique R such that R plus 3 is 5. But what we're doing here, A minus B is the C such that C and B is equivalent to A. But of course, there is no unique C such that C and B is equivalent to A. There's any number of statements whose conjunction with B, I mean, if A implies B, there's any number of statements whose conjunction with B is A. So if I so let A be, I raise my arm, and let B be, my arm goes up, so candidates for C. If I raise my arm goes, sorry, if my arm goes up, I raise my arm. There's a number of others, I can't remember them right now. Anyway, so that's kind of like the range. So at one end, you've got A minus B would just be A again. The other end, it's going to be the conditional, if B, then A. Okay, so he says, yeah, it's not the case that there's exactly one statement R such that R in my arm goes up is logically equivalent to I raise my arm. So there's a presupposition of the question, like what is the remainder, fails, and so it's not a sensible question. Now comes J.L. Hudson in response to this. He says, look, one candidate for the role of P minus Q is the material conditional, if Q then P. And he says, if there's a bunch of different propositions whose conjunction with Q gives you P, then you need some like principle of selection. You could like try to take the strongest one, but the strongest one is just going to be P again, so that's not really going to get you anything interesting. What is the weakest hypothesis such that together with Q gives you P? It's the material conditional, if Q, then P. So that's Hudson's suggestion for what the remainder is supposed to be. So we've got a thesis here. One kind of feels in some weird way that there has to be a remainder, but in fact there's no must about it. The whole notion really doesn't make a lot of sense. Then the antithesis, this is Hudson, a remainder always exists. And then he adds, it's the weakest R such that R and Q gives you back P, which is the material conditional. I'm going to suggest a synthesis which says, you know, a remainder sometimes exists and sometimes doesn't. Here's the pattern that a remainder should follow, and I'll develop this a little bit. So look at the sort of the diagram to the right. That's logical space. On the left-hand side, there's a Q column. So Q is going to play the role of B, and P is going to be A. Okay. So you've got P, which is that little square in the Q column near the top. P implies Q. The question is, what's left over if you subtract Q from P? Graphically, that's what if you cut P loose from the boundary between Q and not Q? Let it sort of pass freely through the boundary between Q and not Q to sort of take up a position elsewhere in logical space. So here's a way to think about what's going on there. You want let R be the thing that does this the best. You want an R that behaves just like P does in the Q region. In other words, the Q region is where you're kind of launching from. I call it home in a way. So the Q region is home. That's where you already have P defined. You're trying to extrapolate it to this away region where it isn't yet defined. So the idea would be you use what intelligence you can gather from home to figure out what the right direction would be for away. Well, the intelligence you have from home is kind of what is the difference between, say, P and Q worlds and not P and Q worlds. There's a line within the Q region between the P and the not P. That's the line you want to continue. So that's the basis, and then the idea will be that the remainder should have its truth value controlled on the right-hand side by the same kinds of factors that control its truth value on the left-hand side. We've got to sort of figure out exactly what that means. And so here's the truth in... So I was giving the truth in thesis, the Mysterian view. So if it's really the case that, you know, if Q then P is the best you can come up with to play the role of remainder, then it really is not going to work. Because thinking of it graphically, think about what if Q then P would be in that graph. It corresponds to P within the Q region, but then when it sort of travels out to the away region, it just balloons to 5 times its size to occupy the whole not Q region, because if Q then P is not Q or P. So I would call that not going on in the same way. Another way to think of it is this. What we have in mind, so I raise my arm minus my arm goes up. So what we have in mind is something that is insensitive to whether or not my arm goes up. That's why you subtracted it. The idea in subtracting my arm goes up was the result should not be false just because it's false that my arm goes up. But the if Q then P proposal overshoots the mark because not only does it make it not false because my arm doesn't, it makes it true. In other words, you're just supposed to sort of remove the implication of falsity on the basis of my arm not going up. But now we've got not Q or P. My arm doesn't go up or I raise it. So it's now going to be true if my arm doesn't go up. So intuitively, so think of an intuitive case like this. You know, say, snow is white and cold. You want to subtract snow is white. You want to get snow is cold. This theory doesn't let you get snow is cold. It lets you get if snow is white, then snow is white and cold. Okay, so that's a much weaker statement, and it's true in worlds where, yeah, I'll give some more examples in a minute. So here is the claim. This is going to be our synthesis. So P minus Q, the logical difference, the incremental content of P relative to Q, right, is going to be an R, as I said, that agrees with P on the left-hand side when we're home, and kind of continues in the same way on the right-hand side when we're away. Okay. Here's the claim. An R satisfying these conditions is always available. Okay. Now you might think, haven't you just contradicted yourself because you just already gave some examples where it seemed as though you really couldn't subtract Q from P. To give one more, that so the one that always gets mentioned at this point, try to subtract, you know, X is red from X is, sorry, X is colored from X is red, or try to subtract X is red from X is scarlet, or try to subtract we danced from we danced badly, or try to subtract we swam from we swam 3 laps. What's left? 3 laps? So there's lots of cases where intuitively it makes no sense to ask what is the remainder, but I've just said there always is a remainder. Okay, so I'm going to say that objection lumps together two notions of well-defined that are easy to confuse. So this one question is the well-definedness of the subtraction operation itself. The operation is well-defined. If given any P and any Q that it implies, there is a thing P minus Q. The second notion of well-defined is this thing P minus Q is defined all over logical space. So you can reconcile the two claims by saying there always is this thing P minus Q, but in bad cases, like say scarlet minus red, it's only defined, the proposition is only defined on the red worlds, right? So scarlet minus red, we can be sure of this. If a thing is scarlet minus red is true. If it's crimson, scarlet minus red is false. As long as it's red, we just have to ask whether it's scarlet or not. Okay, what we're really after for a non-trivial case of extrapolation is you want P minus Q to be defined not just in the home region, which is what we just got, say just in the red region, but you want a notion, say, of scarlet minus red such that it makes sense to ask of, say, a green thing whether it has what scarlet adds to red. Okay, now that's an example where just thinking, you know, just off the top of your head, it seems very unlikely that you could determine what it would mean for a green thing to have what scarlet adds to red. So I want to sort of like put some definite kind of structure around that question. So here we go. How do we construct a proposition R for P minus Q to express? I'm going to be like vague about sentences versus propositions. Sometimes I'll use like script R on the handout. That's kind of the proposition as opposed to the sentence, but I won't worry about that. So what kind of conditions would we like this remainder to meet? And I'm just going to sort of describe them in a general way. Like there's going to be two cross-cutting desiderata, kinds of condition. So on the one hand, we've got home versus away. We're going to have conditions that speak to R's behavior at home, in other words, in that left-hand strip, versus away in the rest of the diagram on the right-hand side. Here's another way of dividing them up. We're going to have conditions that speak to whether R is true in a world, yes or no, and also conditions that speak to how and why R would be true in a world. What we've been calling truth makers, or ways of being true. So if you put those two together, you get four possibilities. Home classifying conditions, home rationalizing, away classifying, away rationalizing. Here's the approach that I think makes sense, but I won't go through the details of it. You start with home classifying. You ask, when should R be true in the home worlds? When should R be true in the Q worlds? And the answer to that is obvious. Exactly when P is true, right? So when should I raise my arm minus it goes up be true in worlds where my arm actually goes up? Obviously, the worlds where I raise my arm. Where should scarlet minus red be true among the red worlds? Well, the ones that are scarlet. Okay, so that's the home classifying. That's like that's where we're gonna like that's the one solid thing we've got, and we're gonna try to like parlay that into a story about how the extrapolation works. Then the next thing after you get home classifying is home rationalizing. Why is a world in the P part of the Q region as opposed to the not P part? So I'm not asking why is it P. I'm asking why is it P given that it's Q. Okay. So you could imagine, say, that Q is, say, Florence. Florence is a fox. Q is Florence is a fox. P is Florence is a vixen. Okay. So the question will be, so the P region is where Florence is a vixen. What distinguishes the vixen worlds from the general run of fox worlds? I know you know the answer, right? So the reason that Florence would be a vixen, given that she's a fox, is that she's female. Okay, well, that is a kind of a notion that makes sense. That's kind of a factor controlling truth and falsity that makes sense, even when a thing isn't a fox. So that's a case where we probably can push the P, not P, boundary from the Q region out into the rest of logical space. Okay. So that's, we've got home rationalizing. That's why is a world in the P part of the Q region as opposed to the not P part. Then we're going to have, after that, away rationalizing. So why would a world be a world where the remainder is true or false? Answer, because that world has whatever it was that made a world be P and Q rather than not P and Q. So in other words, in the case of the vixen, the reason a world would be classified as one in which the remainder, vixen minus fox, is true, is because it had whatever distinguished the vixen worlds from the fox worlds originally, which was being female. So female should be the factor, say, that controls whether a world where Florence, say, isn't a fox, is one that counts as satisfying the remainder. And then finally, there's a final question. How do we go from the reasons that R might be true or false, the factors controlling its truth value on the right-hand side of the diagram, to an answer to whether it's true or false? That's the going from away rationalizing to away classifying. And the answer is going to be something like this. If you know the reasons why R is supposed to be true or false in these away worlds, then just say that it's true if one of the reasons for it to be true obtains. And we should probably also add, and none of the reasons for it to be false obtains, because that can happen too. It's going to be false when there's a reason for it to be false that obtains, but not the other way around. Okay, so that's the general picture of how it's supposed to work. I won't go through the... So those four conditions, agreement, reasons, integrity, projection, those are my attempt to make those things kind of precise. But it all comes out to the thing on the top of the next page. Here's how you decide whether P minus Q is true in a world. It's true in a world if the conditional, if Q then P, has like a homegrown truth maker, a kind of truth maker that applies back on the Q side of the line. So Vixen minus Fox is true in a world if, which might not be a world where Florence is a fox, if the conditional, if a fox, then a vixen, is true for a reason that obtains also on the home side of the line, like being female. Well, female is compatible with being a fox. Okay? So we're going to let P minus Q be true just in case. There's only these two conditionals, if Q then P, if Q then not P. If the one has a truth maker from the left side of the line, a homegrown truth maker, then we're going to call P minus Q true if the other one doesn't. If it's the reverse, then we're going to call it false. Sometimes they'll both. Sometimes neither will. Maybe you can ask me about that later. Now, simplify it a tiny bit further. I'm going to introduce this notion of adding truth. What is it for P to add truth to Q? So the obvious thing is, you know, suppose you've got, you know, a conjunction, and it's got a false conjunct. What does it mean for that conjunction to add truth to the conjunct that's false? Well, the other conjunct should be true. So snow is white and rare adds truth to snow is rare. Insofar as snow is white and rare extends beyond snow being rare, it's right on the money. The only place it goes wrong is where snow is rare goes wrong. It commits no further offenses against truth beyond those that are already committed by that snow is rare conjunct. So we got this notion of adding truth. That's a homegrown truth maker for if Q then P. Adding falsity, a homegrown truth maker for if Q then not P. And then here's the definition. P minus Q is true or false in a world if P adds just truth or just falsity to Q in that world. So now we have the definition, and now we're going to approach this issue, which is how do you tell, or what determines whether Q is extricable from P? Weaker content Q extricable from a stronger content P. There are some cases where it's not extricable at all. Cases of pure inextricability, like scarlet minus red. Then there's cases where it's completely extricable, like same size from congruent to get similarity. Between lies this whole vast region of intermediate possibility. So I want to give you an example of complete inextricability and then complete extricability, and then look at a few in-between ones, and then I'll give a couple philosophical applications. So start with this one that I said doesn't work. Tom is crimson minus Tom is red. And let's go to a world outside the home region of the worlds where Tom is red. We go to a away world, say Tom is green, and we ask, is there anything in the red worlds, in the Thomas red worlds, that makes it true that if he's red, then he's crimson? In other words, it makes up the difference between red and crimson that also obtains in the world where Tom is green. And I want to both say, doesn't seem so, but also to point to the kind of thing that you would want if it was going to be true, so you can laugh at that and say, aha, it can't work that way. So if you read Remarks on Color, which maybe nobody does anymore, in fact, I only did to find these two quotes, Wittgenstein makes a lot of pronouncements about the grammar of color terms. He says things like, you know, what he calls the grammar of color terms, he says, you know, there can be transparent red, but not transparent white. He thinks that's like part of the grammar of red and white. He says things like, a luminous gray is impossible. You can have a luminous pink or yellow, but you can't have a luminous gray. There are articles where people question this. Let's take those two statements, though, as models for like how you might make these windy pronouncements about what's possible for colors and what isn't. Now, this doesn't actually occur in the book, but you can imagine turning the page and it says something like this. Imagine Wittgenstein has discovered that crimson is of its very nature kind of vibrant and glorious in a way that makes sense even apart from the question of red versus not red. Okay. And now we go to Tom, who's green. Let's imagine Tom is this like lackluster sort of green. Okay? So does Tom have the feature that makes up the difference between red and crimson? No, because Tom's color is not vibrant and glorious. So to the extent you can convince yourself that crimson, is the conjunction of red with vibrant and glorious, then you should say that it makes sense to ask whether Tom satisfies the remainder. It's just a question of whether he's vibrant. So it sounds like, I'm hoping that makes just enough sense that you can see it's ridiculous, but you can see what is ridiculous. Okay, so this is not going to work. That's what would have to work. So that's a case of perfect inextricability. You can't classify Tom in the green worlds or yellow worlds at all. Okay, here's a case of perfect extricability. So take the hypothesis, the number of red stars in the nth galactic year. Galactic year is like how long it takes I won't be able to explain it properly, but it's a really long time. There's only been about 10 of them so far since the universe began. So here's the hypothesis, that in the nth galactic year, the number of red stars is 2 to the exponent n. Okay? Number n is the number of red stars, n galactic years in. The equation that's being proposed is the number of stars in the nth galactic year is 2 to the exponent n. Does this extrapolate from the worlds where numbers exist to the worlds where they don't? I said my little apologia for like talking about worlds where numbers do or don't exist a couple times ago. You definitely don't want me to repeat that. So we'll just like take it as though it makes sense. There's worlds with numbers and worlds without numbers. So what does it take to make it true in a world with numbers that if there are numbers, then the number of red stars in the nth galactic year is 2 to the n? Well, here's what it would take, assuming that we begin at 2 to the 0, which is 1. So here's what it would take. There should be one red star at the beginning, 2 red stars in the first galactic year, 4 in the next one, 8 in the next one, 16 in the next one, etc. That's what it would take. That can happen even if there aren't any numbers. So there's a fact about the concrete world that, so to speak, tells you what it takes to go from the existence of numbers to the truth of this numerical claim. And it's just about how many red stars there are at different times, which is, if you like, adjectivally numerical, but there's no numerical substantive in it. So what does it take for in the number region to make it false that if numbers, then, to make it true that if numbers, then the number of red stars in the nth galactic year is not 2 to the n. It's not the case that it's always 2 to the n. Well, so, for example, here's what would do it. If there is always one red star, or if there was 1 and then 3 and then 9 and then 27, go to any world you like. One of these scenarios will obtain. Either there's going to be 0, 1, 2, 4, 8, da-da-da, red stars, or there's going to be not that. If it's not that, then P minus Q is false. If it is that, P minus Q is true. So there's a perfect extricability of there are numbers from the number of red stars is 2 to the n. I mean, of course, you know, ignoring various other presuppositions that there might be to statements about stars. Yeah. Okay, now here's the intermediate case. Take the I raise my arm case. When does I raise my arm add just falsity to my arm goes up, right? That's going to be the cases where my arm doesn't go up, but if this kind of fact whereby I raise my arm adds just falsity to my arm goes up obtains in a world where my arm is down, then we'll say the remainder is false. So here's a world where that has a fact in it that ensures that if my arm goes up, then I don't raise it. A world where I'm unconscious, say. A world where I'm unconscious, right? Assuming that you cannot raise your arm if you're unconscious, even if my arm goes up in such a world, that will not constitute a case of my raising it, right? Because I'm unconscious. Or if I'm dead, or if I have, well, I don't know. You can think of various other far-out possibilities. It's easier to think of ways that it could be that I raise my arm adds falsity to my arm goes up than to think of ways where it adds truth. Because what would it mean for it to add truth? There would have to be a fact that guarantees that should my arm go up, I raised it. And you first think, okay, well, I tried to raise my arm. That would do it. But remember, we need every single world where I There's got to be a fact that obtains, namely, I try to raise my arm, we're suggesting, that guarantees the truth of if my arm goes up, I raised it. But as you're already thinking to yourself, I tried to raise my arm does not do that, because I could have tried ineffectively to raise my arm at the very same moment as somebody pulled my hand up, or a gust of wind blew it up. Okay? So then, I tried to raise my arm isn't strong enough. Well, how do we make it stronger? Well, how about I effectively tried to raise my arm? That's strong enough. But I effectively tried to raise my arm is just the same as I raised my arm. So therefore, it's not going to be defined in the away region. We're not getting any interesting extrapolation at all. Okay, one more kind of example. Go back to the Mondale-Reagan thing. S knows that P minus P. It's kind of easy to think of how S knows that P minus P could be false in a world where it isn't the case that P. Okay, so like, I know that snow is black minus snow is black. That's probably true in our world, just because I strongly deny that snow is black. Right? That's enough to ensure that even if it is the case, say, unbeknownst to me, I don't know it. Okay. Here's an interesting question that I only just started to think about, and I want some of you to think of examples if you can, because I've got one that probably doesn't work, but again, I'll give you the sense of the kind of thing. Can you find a world where P is false, where S knows that P does add truth to P? In other words, where S knows that P falls short of being true just by the fact that it isn't the case that P. That's the only thing it does wrong, so to speak. So the knowledge claim is completely right except for the fact that the complement isn't known. So here's my example. So imagine that we kind of look into the question of whether there's an afterlife. And it turns out there's much more evidence for this than we'd ever imagined. There's fantastic evidence that there's life after death. And so we all form the very reasonable hypothesis that there is life after death. And let's suppose that all the trends were really pointing that way, but for some fluky reason, like, you know, God in a fit of pique took it away or something like that, there happens not to be life after death. Okay. Well, life after death was something that's going to come along after we were dead anyway, right? It wasn't going to sort of give evidence of itself during our lifetime. So you might think, if we're totally well justified in thinking there's life after death, and all that goes wrong is that there just isn't, you know? Then we knew it, minus there is life after death. So that's my proposal for that. Okay, now I'm going to just give a couple of examples of subtraction as a philosophical tool, and then I'll stop. So, actually, I'll give it to you. Yeah. So, first is, this is very general. So, think about philosophical analysis, which maybe nobody does anymore. But there was this thing, philosophical analysis, the way it works is, you've got some elusive target concept or content, and you're trying to sort of give an informative kind of explication of what's involved in that. Here's how you do it. Suppose it's P that you're trying to reach. Here's how you do it. You find a bunch of things, Q1, Q2, Q3, that are all weaker than P, and if you conjoin them, they add up to P. Right? So, how do we get the analysis of a bachelor? Well, unmarried is weaker than bachelor, male is weaker than bachelor, marriageable age is weaker than bachelor. You put all those together, supposedly, not the Pope, etc., and you get is a bachelor. Okay, but here's an other possibility that we might consider. Rather than approaching the target concept from below, what are the prospects, in some cases, perhaps, not in all, of doing analysis from above, where you overshoot the target concept, so to speak, and then pull back the extra stuff? And indeed, I gave some examples in the beginning where philosophers seem like they've tried to do that. Now, there have been some like, spectacular failures along these lines, if you agree with me, that things like narrow content or the jewel-like act of will that Kant speaks of, those were, in a way, there's the attempt to explain what the jewel-like act of will is. You say, well, it's like what you do to act except take away anything that isn't in your control, right? And I take it most of us think it's not clear there's anything kind of left there, okay? Similar things are said about narrowly believing that water is wet. So those are some like cautionary tales about you better not like think this is going to work automatically. But It's not to say that it will never work. How else are we to understand if we do? They're all controversial. Law-likeness, quasi, a bunch of people think they understand quasi-memory. If this is not how, I don't know how. Force versus duress, necessity versus duress, or scare quotes uses of moral terms. I mean, when you think about it, you actually can, you know, it's not hard to convince yourself that there's only so far you can take a scare quotes use of a moral term. You know, that if people used to think there's like a descriptive core to like thick moral concepts, they don't think that so much anymore. There not being a descriptive core is precisely what sets limits on how extricable good is from courageous. Okay. Okay. Final example. So I presented subtraction as a way of canceling excessive, unwanted content. And I've acted like that's like a different thing than we ordinarily do. We have no ordinary language for subtraction. But the negation operator itself is sometimes said to have this exact function. So here's a thing that Strassen says. He says, a man who contradicts himself may have succeeded in exercising his vocal cords, but from the point of view of imparting information or communicating facts, it is as if he had never opened his mouth. Contradiction is like writing something down and erasing it, or putting a line through it. A contradiction cancels itself and leaves nothing. So this is obviously wrong, right? So if I say, like, I'll be there at dinner, I won't be there at the dinner, you don't say, you might as well not have opened his mouth. I mean, maybe you can sort of imagine that won't be there at dinner cancels the earlier kind of assertion of will be there at dinner, but it's very hard to see how the earlier assertion can cancel the later one. Presumably, the take-home message is, I won't be at dinner, right? Strassen says the take-home message is nothing at all. He gives some analogies. Running up a flag and letting it down again. P is running it up, not P is letting it down again. Okay, so suppose Strassen is wrong about this, that not P is not really, negation is not a device for just taking something back and leaving a clean slate. It does more than that. It takes something back and it puts the opposite in its place. Well, what do we say to take something back and leave nothing in its place? Here's an idea. Suppose I say, it's raining out, and then I realize my evidence was wrong. I might just say, it might not be raining. So it might not be raining. It might not be raining doesn't say, it's not raining. That would have put the opposite in place, but it might not be raining. It just seems like it strikes, it's raining from the record. So on the handout, 2, near the bottom of the second last page, says, look, maybe the conversational role, if it might be that not A, is A plus it might be that not A leaves the record clear. Nothing has been asserted. But of course, we know something else that has the result that nothing has been asserted, which is just subtracting a thing from itself. A minus A is nothing has been asserted. So here's a proposal that I'll just sort of throw out there for you. If you put these two things together, you get the following idea. Adding, it might be that not A, or saying, putting that forward in conversation, is not an assertive act, it's an unassertive act. It's a subtractive act. To say, it might be that not A is to subtract A from whatever your going view is of the information state that we're kind of developing over time, the context set or whatever it might be. This has a couple of features. I'll just mention one that I like. I think I mentioned early on that sometimes you can object to an analysis. You might try to object to an analysis, not that it gets the truth conditions wrong, but that it has the wrong subject matter. And I talked about, you know, it might be that phi, you might think, is not really about anybody's information. It's not saying that my information is limited. It's not talking about that. It's like Bob might be in his office. I'm just talking about Bob in his office. And you might ask, how could you get Bob might be in his office to be just about Bob in his office and not about somebody's information? Well, here's how. I take it that a statement has the same subject matter as its negation, and I would assume that the kind of speech act of withdrawing something would be equivalent subject matter-wise to the speech act of laying it down. But might, on this theory, is just those two things done in succession. Might is just negating and then switching from assertion to cancellation. So that's one idea. And now I'm done.